London Calling. David here. What's in a name? Asks Romeo. Quite a bit, actually. In this instance, one London street name. One very famous London street name. And which one do I have my sights on? Well, let's close in. What's the most famous street name in London? Is it the Strand, or Fleet Street, or Piccadilly, or Park Lane, or Oxford Street, or Regent Street, or Pall Mall, or the Mall, or the Embankment, or Whitehall? Big, important, and for sure, famous streets, all of them. But I don't think any of them is in the winner's circle. The one I'd put my money on is a much smaller street, tiny really, a little cul-de-sac. But boy, does it punch above its weight. I'm talking, a lot of you will have guessed, Downing Street. So you were just about there when you said Whitehall, because Downing Street is, of course, a little turning off Whitehall. And the two of them are kith and kin. Whitehall is Government Street, and Downing Street is world-renowned for number 10 Downing Street, the British equivalent of the White House, the official residence and office of the Prime Minister. You can say Downing Street, and everybody understands what you mean. The name of the street is shorthand, just as the actual address, number 10, is. It's maybe, after 1066, the most famous number in British history. The name of the street is shorthand for the Prime Minister, and thus the very heart of the government. So what is in that name, Downing Street? And I ask that question partly because I've been intrigued, like every other sentient human being in this country, by the ongoing heated, deeply felt debate about statues, and whether some of them should come down if the man, so far it's always been a man, commemorated was, not to put too fine a point on it, an evil bastard when he was alive. A key player in some really vile goings-on when he was flesh and blood. For example, an immensely rich, leading citizen of, say, Bristol, who amassed his fortune from the slave trade. And there's a statue of him, put up in many cases because the great crime that made his fortune got laundered, so to speak. You know, he gave the money to good causes, philanthropy, that sort of thing. Well, the statues debate, if we're honest, we should be having that same discussion about street names. And look, personally, I can be pretty conservative about these matters. Well, conservative for someone who's a lot more radical now than he was when he was a capital R radical, angry young man 50 years ago. A young man in a towering rage against the wickedness of the United States was visiting upon the people of a poor little country in Southeast Asia. A lot of my conservatism today has to do with what rich, powerful, speculative builders are doing to our cities. I set a lot of store by the apothem, unless it's absolutely necessary to change something, it's absolutely necessary not to change it. I think there's a lot to be said for that view, that approach. So that's where a lot of me is coming from in the matter of tearing things down, whether it's statues or buildings or names. Names like Downing Street, the most famous street name in London, maybe in the country. And yep, conservative though I am on the point generally, I think there's a case to be made for raising out the name Downing Street, renaming the street. Why? Because George Downing, after whom the street is named, was a vile piece of work. But first, the house itself. It's not nearly as modest as it looks from the outside. Firmly fixed in everybody's mind is that image of a single policeman in front of the famous door in what appears to be a fairly normal-sized terraced house. Originally three houses, a mansion overlooking St. James's Park, a townhouse, and a cottage, it adds up to over 100 rooms. The Prime Minister's private apartment is on the third floor, though it's fairly common knowledge these days that the PM and his fiancée and child are in number 11 Downing Street, which historically was the official residence and office of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. The townhouse was one of several built by George Downing in the 1680s. It was speculative property development. Anyway, the real story here is Downing himself. He was born in either 1624 or 1625. He was the son of an Inner Temple barrister who was also a very active Puritan. Indeed, he was a missionary. When George Downing was 13 or 14 years old, the family took off for the New World. They went at the invitation of Massachusetts Bay Governor John Winthrop, settled in Salem, yes, the Salem famous in history for the witchcraft trials. Young Downing attended Harvard College. He was one of nine students in the first graduating class, and he was hired by Harvard as the college's first tutor. Years ago, as a young guide, I joked that we, America, educated the man who built the Prime Minister's residence, and the Brits repaid the favor by burning down the White House in the War of 1812. But forget the Harvard business for a minute. Downing should really be remembered on both sides of the Atlantic for being the key player in wresting New York from the Dutch. Anyway, the New York deal was up ahead. We're still in the 1640s. Our young man on the make was just passing through Harvard. Notwithstanding that tutorial appointment, he put in 3 years there, just over the Charles River from Boston. But then he was off to the West Indies. Off to the West Indies as a man of the cloth. Off to the West Indies on a ship that carried slaves. His godliness's role on that slave ship? Preacher. An instructor of the seamen. This is what the young Reverend Downing wrote to his cousin, John Winthrop, governor of Connecticut, about the West Indies as the land of opportunity. If you go to Barbados, you shall see a flourishing island with many able men. I believe that they have bought this year no less than 1,000 Negroes. And the more they buy, the better able are they to buy, for in a year and a half, they will earn, with God's blessing, as much as they cost. What a monster. And he's only getting started. Anyway, from that paradise of slavery, it's back to England. Downing becomes the chaplain to the regiment of the man who'd sponsored his American education. And from there on out, wow, what a career. Grasping, always looking out for number one, a model of unscrupulousness, coining the stuff. All in all, a nasty piece of work. He was an arch Republican. He was Cromwell's Scoutmaster General. He supported the execution of Charles I. He was a spy master, a diplomat, an economist, and a turncoat par excellence. Come the Restoration, he smartly changed his tune, got right in with King Charles II. He blamed his republicanism on principles sucked in the New World. And he now saw the heir of his ways. What a schmuck. In theory and in practice. Sure enough, he helped hunt down some of his former comrades. He engineered their arrest. And he was a key player, a mover and shaker, in the execution of three of the regicides. These were people who'd been his comrades. The great diarist Samuel Pepys had his number. Pepys called him a perfidious rogue. Nor did he fool the other great diarist of the age, John Evelyn. Evelyn said, "From a pedagogue and fanatic preacher not worth a groat, he has become excessive rich." Citing parliamentary gossip, Evelyn said, "He keeps six whores in pay, and yet has got £40,000. Basically, he established a new standard in unscrupulous self-interest. We're talking an international reputation for being a scoundrel. In the words of one of his biographers, "In New England, it became a proverbial expression to say of a false man who betrayed his trust that he was an errant George Downing." So, to sum up, we've got a villainous individual who served Cromwell in London as Scoutmaster General and then as Minister to Holland, where remaining after 1660, he betrayed several regicides to Charles II. And to round the whole thing up, Downing Street in London is inappropriately called after this double-faced traitor whose name for a time was a synonym for infamy. What's in a name? That's what's in a name in this instance. Good night from London.